You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Hello and welcome, you beautiful MFs. You're beautiful inside and out, but you knew that. I'm just reminding you. Today, I'll do some sports. I'll tell you about some interesting insights from a book that I'm reading right now. And I'll give you an update on the best movie ever, because I didn't do that last week. So we're due. But first, let's do some funny stuff. I don't know that this one's so funny, but they'll get funnier as I go here. Raheem Palmer said, if you told me in the 90s that Snoop Dogg and Mike Tyson would have family-friendly images in 2026, while Tiger Woods would become a complete degenerate, I would have thought you lost your mind, but that's current reality. I don't know that Tiger Woods is a complete degenerate, but he does, I hope he gets help. I know what it's like to navigate the world in chronic pain, and I can tell you, when you start Googling for what to do about it, 99% of the results are about emotional pain, which is not what I need. And I'm thinking Bill Cosby would be another one that we never would have suspected would be in trouble like this. But again, hope Tiger gets help, because he is endangering the public when he drives like that, when he's high. The Babylon Bee headline said the black half of Tiger Woods was tased by cops. The Asian half crashes car. Alaskan Tom posted the day it happened. He said, out drove Tiger Woods today. I saw where the Fox News folks were saying that he's rich enough, talking about Tiger Woods, that he should just get a car service, which is something only rich people would say. Am I right? Because they too get a car service, even to work. Not a taxi. They don't take the subway. They don't take Uber. It's a car service. And I would bet they don't call their dad dad either. No, it is father. Father said we should take a car service from the Upper East Side to Brooklyn. I don't know. Bob Golan said this. He said, used the transgender bathroom yesterday. Had to take a she-it. This is one from Froberist. He says, white people be like, I'm in public. Let me take my phone off speakerphone. All right, let's get into the meat and potatoes. Kay Paxis, he shared an excerpt from a book called On Being Certain by Robert Burton. And I have not read it, but it's about hitting this excerpt, hitting a baseball. He was talking about why hitting a baseball is damn near impossible. And he writes that the ball travels 9 feet before your brain even registers that it's left the pitcher's hand. By the time you see where it is, it's already something else. Perception is always lagging. So hitting, he's saying, isn't so much about reacting. It's about predicting and then committing to that prediction before you have confirmation. Because by the time you have confirmation, the ball is already past you. And so much of life is that way. If you are 80% sure, you dive in. You don't wait till you're 100% sure. You got to make calculated risk, and that risk would be the 20% that it doesn't work out or you fall on your face. A common thing for hitting coaches, and maybe my favorite thing they would ever say to me, was to trust your hands. And I always liked that because of how important it is. And I think it resonated with me because I know some of the crazy numbers behind how little time you have to process the type of pitch they're throwing or the speed, and making a decision whether to swing or not. So when I was a kid, I was 8, maybe 9. I attended a college baseball camp at the school that I would eventually go to play baseball, which is crazy to think about. I even remember standing in the outfield out in the warning track and wondered if I'd someday be able to hit a baseball out of the park, out of this huge park that I was looking at. But at this camp, I remember one of the college coaches holding a baseball in his hand and telling us about how little time you have to react to a pitch. So knowing all that, it's important that you have the trust in your ability to get your hands to the ball quickly. One thing I don't hear talked about is that as a hitter, the ball gets bigger as it gets closer to you. And that was something I would think about because I remember my Papa Fats, he used to tell my brother, who was maybe 13 at the time, I think that's the age at which you're allowed to throw curveballs, 13, at least that's how it was in the town where I was from. And yeah, 13. And what he told him was that the way you pick up a curveball out of the pitcher's hand, the way you know it's a curveball coming is you pick up the seams on the ball. And on a curveball, the seams spinning will look like a red dot because the seams on the ball are red. And by the time it crosses the plate, it'll look like a big old beach ball. That's exactly what he said. I'd like to know what his eyesight was. The ball getting bigger seems obvious when you think about it. Any object moving toward you will appear smallest when it's farthest away, and then in your field of vision, and it gets bigger as it gets closer to you. So reminding yourself of that can help to build confidence as you step into the batter's box, because it's so important that you have confidence in your hands as well as your eyes, and then you let muscle memory do its thing, all the practice you put in. How about this ABS implemented in MLB, in Major League Baseball? ABS stands for Automatic Ball Strike System, where the hitter and the catcher have 2 seconds to challenge a call. Some of these guys are really showing off their eyesight. I talked about last week how Major League Baseball players have superhuman visual acuity, best in the world. Well, studies have found that over 81% of players in certain Major League Baseball organizations, meaning rookie ball up through the minors into the big leagues, that they have an average of 20/15 vision or better, with some even hitting 20/9. I didn't even know it went past 20/10. That's supposedly what Ted Williams had. And even umpires have to go through a rigorous eye exam before the season. And they're required to have, all they're required to have is 20/20 vision. But at least there's a test. I didn't know that. Let's talk March Madness. We saw the UConn, or I don't know if you did, but I did, the UConn game on Sunday, where Duke was up 40-21 at one point, and UConn was 3 of 20 from 3 in the first half, but then they rallied back in the second half to where Duke was up 2 with 10 seconds left and had the ball. So they throw it in bounds, and they start playing hot potato with the basketball instead of allowing themselves to just be fouled and win. And one of the boozer boys, he must have been boozing because he made the biggest bonehead blunder in the NCAA tournament, probably since Chris Webber's timeout call when he didn't have one. Remember, that was 33 years ago now. Jeez. And I'm in a bracket this year with 18 dudes. I'm one of 18, and it looks like the winner is going to be the one who picked all chalk, which is, so he has all 4 number one seeds in the final 4. And I was in the running for a long time. I had Illinois in there as a 3, but he's going to win. Even with Illinois being a 3 and UConn being a 2, he picked the other 2 correctly. They're number 1s, Arizona and whoever they're playing. And it looks like he'll have the most points by just picking favorites, which is kind of chicken shit, but I'm probably just jealous. Did you see where the UConn coach's mom said holy effing shit when they hit the game winner? That was awesome. You can't hear it, but it's clear what she's saying as a camera zooms in on her face and right after the shot went in, and it's clear what she's saying. So, pure awesomeness. Pure madness, I should say. This is easily the most exciting time of the year in sports, just about every year. And speaking of madness, did you see what UConn's coach did immediately after the shot went in? The way he bowed up to the ref? That probably should have been a technical foul on 2 free throws awarded to Duke for the win. But Dan Hurley, he's definitely got the basketball gods with him, I think. But he had encountered that ref many times before. They were probably buddies, so I think that's why they let it slide. If he didn't like him, if they had gotten in a bunch of arguments throughout the game, then I think that would be different. But they acted like they were buddies when that happened. But to me, Michigan is the other team. And I think Arizona and Michigan appear to be head and shoulders above everybody else. But that's why they play the games. Anybody can have an off shooting night, you know? And if a Duke kid could do something real dumb, then any college kid could do something real dumb and lose the game for you. The book I'm reading right now is called Balls by Clay Travis, and I started reading it over the weekend. I'm maybe halfway through. You have two basketballs on the cover. And in chapter two, which is called Identity Politics Takes Over Sports, he starts with Bruce Jenner winning gold at the 1976 Olympics that was held in Montreal. Did you realize? I didn't realize this. He was the first gold medal winner to drape himself with the American flag. He started all that. Or she. Who was a he. Now a she. But I call a he because he can't be a she. You follow. And in this book, the author talks about what a big deal it was when Bruce became Caitlin. It was a sit-down interview on ABC with Diane Sawyer. This was 2015. And that interview had over 20 million viewers. And then Jenner wins the ESPY Award for bravery a month later. And so Clay Travis is of the opinion that there was some collusion there between ESPN and ABC, which are both owned by Disney. And we know how woke Disney got during the attempted communist takeover of our country, or the temporary takeover, however you want to call it. They started doing the ESPYs in 93. And the year before they gave the ESPY Award to Jenner, they gave the Arthur Ashe Courage Award to Michael Sam, who was the first openly gay NFL player. And Travis argues in the book that in hindsight, ESPN doing that was the first domino to fall in all of the sports going woke. So the guy Sam, who won the award, he never played in an NFL game. His brief stint of fame was entirely due to what turns him on. Dude's butts. Nothing to do with football. And of course, football fans didn't give a shit about his sexuality, myself included. We only care if you can play, right? Football is the ultimate meritocracy. Sports in general, once you get to the upper levels, you know, you're not playing your son as quarterback of the Saints, you know what I mean? But that marked the first time a player had been so extensively covered by the media based on how he identified instead of how good he was. And of course, this wasn't the first time that identity politics intersected with sports. There was some intersectionality before that term was popularized by the wokesters. We had the Duke lacrosse thing in 06, remember that? Where a bunch of white lacrosse players at Duke were falsely accused of raping a black stripper. And then OJ, of course, killing Nicole and Ron Goldman. That would be another one. That's a situation for me, I think, when I first realized that demons were real. And that they're way more prevalent than we'd like to think. Like the people who cheered when OJ got away with it, or those who served on the jury. When you're presented with overwhelming evidence, I've been through these numbers with you before, but in case you missed that episode, the blood drops at the scene, at the crime scene, they matched OJ Simpson's DNA at a 1 in 170 million clip. That would make him one of possibly two Americans it could have possibly been who did the murders, if we're a country of roughly 340 million people. Nicole Ann Goldman's blood was found in OJ's Bronco and on his socks in OJ's bedroom, where he went after the murder. Nicole's DNA and OJ's socks had odds of 1 in 21 billion. Which is about 13 billion more people than we have on Earth. So only one person in the world could have matched on that. And then they also had OJ's hair on Goldman at the crime scene. They had these rare Bruno Mali shoe prints, size 12. There were only, I think, less than 100 of them made in the world. You had the glove match, one at the crime scene, one next to in the alley behind Cato Kalin's house. In the alley there next to OJ's Brentwood mansion, which has since been torn down. So that's not a tourist destination. And same thing with Bundy, the crime scene. It looks totally different now, where Nicole lived, where the murder happened. Did you know when there's a pattern of domestic abuse and then the wife ends up murdered, there's something called a Bayesian analysis of those cases, which updates the rate of spousal murder given that there was prior abuse, and what they find is that the abuser turns out to be the killer more than 80% of the time. But the jurors laugh that off. I don't know if you remember, they played all that and asked him about it, and they're like, no, acted as if that's a very common occurrence for women to get their ass beat. And then, of course, there was the slow Bronco chase, which interrupted the Rockets finals. They were playing, it was game five. This is June of 94. They were playing the Knicks during Jordan's retirement. I kind of talked a little bit about that last episode. Also, you remember that book he wrote that was supposed to be the hypothetical book titled If I Did It? Do you know both the ghostwriter and the publisher believed that it was a confession? And it was. But I bring all that up because I realize that there are a lot of people out there that can't be reasoned with. And I was talking about demons, and they might be hardcore racists, as in this case, or just real dumb. I mean, it could have been both, or I don't know. But ultimately, when a man nearly decapitates two people and you cheer for him not being punished, I believe that's demonic. Same with Irina Zarutska's killer, which I saw this morning. They're taking down a mural because it doesn't represent their values, which is interesting, right? Like, what does that mean? What are your values? But remember, Irina Zarutska's killer stood up behind her on a bus and slit her throat. And as she bled out to death, all those sitting on the bus around her just stood up and calmly walked out, offering no help to the dying girl. I have no doubt in my mind those same people some 30 years ago cheered when they let OJ get away with murder. They are demons, and they live among us. But the good news is angels do too. Remember the people who cheered when OJ was found not guilty? A lot of them said it was revenge for the Rodney King thing. Going back to Bruce Jenner, Travis, in the book, he asked the question, what if Bruce had become Caitlyn a year after he had won the gold medal for men in 1976 and then attempted to return as a woman's decathlete, which is what he won the gold medal in the 1980 Olympics. So they do the Olympics every 4 years. He said no fan would have accepted that. And Jenner himself or herself or whatever now advocates against men being allowed to compete in women's sports. So he gets it. And he's also a big fan of Donald Trump too, a big supporter. Later in that same chapter, Travis talks about why middle-aged white guys are afraid to say anything about all the insanity in sports, where you had dudes allowed to box women in the Olympics and beat the shit out of them. He said the radio voice for the Sacramento Kings was fired in 2020 for tweeting that all lives matter. This was at the height of all the BLM stuff, the Summer of Love 2020. Also, there was a guy who worked for ESPN who called tennis matches, and he used the phrase gorilla effect to describe Venus Williams running up to play the net. And they fired him because the network said it sounded too much like he was calling Venus a gorilla. So he says, this is Travis talking. He says, could you really afford to lose your job standing up to the left-wing sports insanity? The fear of being canceled and losing your career for speaking up is what allowed the insanity to proliferate, which speaks to the importance of FU money. It's obviously takes somebody like Elon, who has serious FU money. It took him to save free speech, and free speech was saved for the very low cost of $44 billion. He makes a powerful point about young men in the book, too. Like I said, I'm probably only halfway through it, but he says young men grew up in a world where Trump has been a character in their entire lives. And I like, he uses the word character in the book, and I like that because it plays into my view that we're watching the best movie ever. And let's let this count as the update in the best movie ever, because it's got some political stuff. But I did miss it last week. Sorry about that. But he says the media portrayed Trump as this rebel that nobody liked, and he was a bad man and blamed for everything. And that was just like young white males. They were blamed. White men have been the enemy of the communists for a long time. So he says young people like his son are just like Trump. And like many of us, we see a lot of Trump in us. And intuitively, these boys know that everything they said about Trump isn't true because it's not true about them. So, like, how could they have caused all the problems in the world when they haven't even had a chance to impact the world yet? They're still teenagers, barely teenagers. So Travis said that his oldest son was 8 when Trump came down the escalator in 2015, and he's now in college. So he said Trump was the bad boy bearing the brunt of what did he say? He was bearing the brunt of blame for everything he hadn't actually done. And so in that sense, he became these teenage boys. He became their spirit animal or the ultimate bad guy who was actually a good guy. And they watched how in the days following January 6th, how they kicked Trump off of Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and Spotify and Snapchat, IG, Reddit, TikTok, even Pinterest. They banned Trump from even having an account. And so coming to realize that they could censor a billionaire former president, or actually he was still president at that time, if they could do that to him, what chance did the rest of us stand if all these companies collude to shut us up? Not to mention trying to bankrupt him and send him to prison for the rest of his life and debanking and going after his family and his friends. And even they went after any lawyer who tried to represent him. And ultimately, there were attempts on his life. So communism is bad, friends. So what Trump had to do was start his own social media company, True Social, which added several $1 billion to his wealth. And so the commies, they didn't ultimately succeed. It backfired brilliantly, turning Trump into a sort of free speech martyr. And Travis made an insightful argument on this. He said that the communists silencing their opposition was their undoing because it made leftist arguments weak and uncontested. Because when you rig the debate in your favor through the use of algorithms and capturing media and universities and all that, you're not able to strengthen your arguments, that's true. Conservatives have always known what leftists think because the mainstream had been captured and the universities and science, HR departments. And so your leftist friends, if you still have any, they know or they don't know what conservatives think, whereas so conservatives know what progressives think. They never heard arguments from the other side. And Travis's point was, when the referee is always on your side, you're not going to develop strong arguments. You get used to seeing a scoreboard where you always start a few touchdowns ahead. So leftists won the battle, but lost the war, which is what you'd expect since they don't consider second and third order effects of their actions or the policies they extol. That never concerns them. They're not concerned about consequences. They want to think well of themselves in the now. And for young men's part, they flock to Trump because everything he did was banned. And so what do young boys want to see most? That which they're not supposed to see. Of course, young boys don't change. What young boy wouldn't try to read about the guy who was banned from the internet? Even I would do that, and I'm getting old. There were no Kings protests last weekend, and one of our genius, mentally stable communist senators, Miss Hirono, she tweeted, "Donald Trump is not, never will be, and never has been a king." To which Molly Hemingway said, "Correct. Not sure why you're defending him this way, but correct." You know, if these miserable communists were honest, when asked what they're doing out at these protests, they would just say, "We're out here fighting imaginary enemies." Bennett's phylactery had a great comment on the No Kings stuff, too. He said, "Went to No Kings protest today. Difficult to draw historical analogies because everyone is so fat and comfortable. All the anger is about hypothetical, abstract, future injuries. Almost seems like real suffering might actually make people less pissy and aggrieved because they'd be busy." Yeah. Tyrus had a good point, too. He said that if these people holding the hammer and sickle flags and organizing themselves in all these major cities, if they were the least bit physically threatening, then we'd have to do something about it. And so, yeah, he said if brown people were marching with hammer and sickle flags and they were physically threatening, then something would have to be done. But, you know, it's mostly childless women and old folks and white people, awfuls. So not too intimidating, but we can't expect somebody who couldn't tell you the difference between a man and a woman. We can't expect that same person to know the difference between a king and a president. And I know some people are concerned that modern communists aren't taken seriously enough. Like, is that something you're worried about? That Trump views them as pathetic losers and knows that if he continues to have success, that Republicans will continue to win elections and therefore never putting any energy toward holding them accountable for all they did to try to destroy the country? I do think if communists take power and proceed to destroy civilization as we know it, it'll largely be due to male weakness, to the feminization of men, to that succeeding, to where we're fully feminized and the opinions of women and children taken too seriously, which I think we're seeing now. I sometimes worry that men haven't been around enough women to know that they're going to complain no matter how good things are. Not all of them, of course, there are exceptions, but when a woman complains a lot, there's a word for that, right? Then we don't have the same word applied to men because it's typically a female thing. There's even a mascot for it. Big Mike, who I've talked about before, has probably had the best existence of any woman who ever lived, potentially, at least top 10. And she complains as much as any woman in the world. How does that work? And I think, too, that this woke era we live through, which Clay Travis argues in the book, started with Colin Kaepernick, actually, at least in sports. But the era from, say, 2015 to 2022, when Elon freed people to talk, to speak honestly about what the hell was going on. I think this era, the woke era, will be talked about 1,000 years from now. I really do. And we're going to look so stupid. They'll be like, you let terrorists into the country and put them up in luxury hotels in Manhattan and allowed them to steal billions of dollars. And that was just in one city, the stealing the billions of dollars thing. You had crazy women cutting off their kids' D&Bs for virtue points. And where were all the men? That's what they're going to say. Where were all the men? Well, son, they'd become feminized to the point where they believed their wife was the boss and they believed all women and decided the future was female. And they're going to be like, what? Dad, oh, you effed us, Dad. Or Pawpaw, or super great, great, great grand. I said 1,000 years, so that'll be a lot of people that somebody 1,000 years is derived from. Nietzsche was writing about all this 150 years ago. He thought society, even at that time, was going through a regression of their culture in all the push for equality and everything. And he thought women were getting, they were deviating from their womanly instincts and trying to be like men, which he viewed as weakness. And I believe that to be true too. And it, like a strong, independent woman, that was all bullshit. A strong woman is generally the opposite of what your average communist thinks a strong woman is. But yeah, a failure to embrace their natural roles is what Nietzsche had a problem with. But what he had was pretty serious. I think he had bad relationships with women through the years, and what he had was bordering on contemptuousness for women, and some would say misogynistic. He would argue that that woman's great art is the lie, and that their highest concern is appearance and beauty, and therefore viewed their constant complaining as a lack of reverence for truth, which he saw as a masculine domain. Combine that with an inability to be objective, and he believed they should never be judges or even serve on a jury. So whether he took that too far, you can be the judge of that, but he thought that the women's lib movement, the push for equality in all things, was, he said, it derived mostly from resentment for others who were better suited to bear children. I don't know if that sounds familiar. That could be part of it, especially when you consider how many childless women ascended to power during our little woke era. Have you noticed that? Kamala, AOC, Randy Weingarten, Big Tish, Letitia James, none of them have kids. Pocahontas, Jasmine Crockett, she's my age, no kids, never been married. Even the Republican Anna Navarro, quote-unquote Republican, all those women are childless. We'd be here all day if I went through all of them, but you'll start noticing it more and more. Let's just hope they don't take power again. I think they'll have a hard time doing it now. All right, I've given you an update on the best movie ever. Let me see if I have some money stuff. I saw where SpaceX, they're planning an IPO. They're targeting a $75 billion raise at $1.75 trillion valuation. Wow. And it'll potentially be among the largest S&P 500 companies. They're saying that could happen as soon as June of this year. Last week, I gave you a rundown of some of the commodities that were surging in price, going up in value. Here are some stocks that are well below their all-time highs. So Apple is down 14% from its all-time high. This is as of Monday this week. I'm recording this on Tuesday. So as of yesterday, gold down 20%, Google down 22%, Amazon off 23%, Tesla down 28%, Palantir down 32%, Meta down 34%, Microsoft down 36% from its all-time high, Bitcoin down 48%, and did I do Nvidia? Nvidia is down 21%. Meta, while still down 34%, they're still profitable. But there's some concern about the culture shifting because a lot of young people prefer YouTube and TikTok to Facebook and Instagram. So they're worried about holding on to those eyeballs. Let me leave you with something about stoicism. This was something I saw. It was an account called Big Brain Philosophy. And I saved it and I thought this would be a good way to close out my next solo podcast. Let me read it to you. It's really good. It says, Marcus Aurelius was the most powerful man on earth. He could have had any woman he desired, been drunk and partying for the rest of his life. No one would have stopped him. He chose none of it. Instead, he spent his nights writing privately about his daily struggle to live better. Those notes, never meant to be published, became Meditations. Great book, by the way. The foundational text of a 2,000-year-old philosophy called Stoicism. Here's what it actually teaches. At its core, Stoicism begins with a single, uncomfortable truth. Most things are not up to you. Your relationships, your finances, your reputation, your body. You can influence these, but never fully control them. Even if you do everything right, misfortune can still find you. The economy collapses, partners leave, bodies fail. But here's where Stoicism flips the script. While you can't control what happens to you, you can always control how you respond. Your opinions, your actions, the position you take toward the world, these belong entirely to you. And according to the Stoics, that's where all your energy should go. This doesn't mean becoming cold or emotionless, a common misconception about Stoicism. The Stoics saw emotion as a deeply human characteristic. What they understood, though, is that it's not the emotion itself that determines your mood. It's the position you take toward it. When you learn to observe your feelings rather than be consumed by them, they lose power over you. Emotions become like waves. They rise, they pass, and you remain standing. That shift in perspective changes everything. Marcus Aurelius lived this philosophy every single day. He had every reason not to. Each morning, before facing the demands running the world's most powerful empire, he practiced what the Stoics called premeditatio malorum, negative visualization. He would mentally prepare himself for the difficulty ahead. Today, I shall be meeting with interference, ingratitude, insolence, disloyalty, ill will, and selfishness. This wasn't pessimism, it was readiness. A mind that has already confronted difficulty isn't rattled when it arrives. Yeah, prepare for the crisis before it comes. He also carried memento mori, the constant reminder that life is temporary, not as a morbid obsession, but as a tool to stay focused on what truly matters and let everything trivial fall away. And that, ultimately, is what Stoicism is about. We live in an age of endless distraction, notifications, opinions, noise competing for our attention at every turn. It's easy to scatter your energy across things you can't change and exhaust yourself in the process. Stoicism offers a quiet, clear alternative. Point your energy toward what's essential and release everything else. Marcus Aurelius had unlimited power, unlimited pleasure, and unlimited distraction available to him. He chose none of it and spent his nights writing about how to be better. That alone might be the most stoic lesson of all. Before we go, just one more thing. If you're a prayerful person, I want to ask you to please keep Coach G in your prayers. G. Cassard, former guest, dear friend. When I had him on the podcast, he told the story of beating cancer. Well, he's about to beat it again. He was diagnosed with a very rare form of cancer. It's called ampullary adenocarcinoma, which I'd never heard of. And his surgery is tomorrow, Wednesday, April 1st. So please say a prayer for G, if you will. And I will chat back at you soon. If I can do anything for you, let me know. And that's all I got. God bless y'all. Thank you.